Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast for today, July 1st, 2019. I'm Noah Rothman, the host of the Commentary podcast today with John Podhoretz out. Commentary Magazine, a 70-year-odd publication of opinion analysis and erudition. It comes to you in your mailbox 11 times a year. You can get an all-access subscription for $29.95 or a digital-only subscription for $19.95. You should check out our issue the double issue this month, because our own Christine Rosen has a fantastic cover piece on the future of Facebook, what to do about the social media giant, and she's here with us today, albeit on remote in Washington, D.C. Hi, Christine.
Hi, Noah.
And with us, as always, is Senior Editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, Noah.
So we haven't talked to you since the second debate. We had a pretty spirited discussion about the first one, but in light of the second one, it's almost like it never happened. It was kind of the undercard debate, if you really want to. If they're not having undercards debates for this set of candidates, they really should, but they're not. But it turned out for the best, because the first one was totally forgettable.
Yeah, I wrote a brief piece after the first one, saying, among other things, how thoroughly unentertaining the first one was, and that maybe the second cohort of candidates would take note and make the second one more interesting. It was certainly more interesting.
It was more interesting. Yeah. And then there was obviously one big takeaway. The big takeaway of the night and the lasting moment from that night was the confrontation between Senator Kamala Harris and Joe Biden over busing. So we can get into the details of that. But I just got off the set on MSNBC, where the conventional wisdom on the left seems to be that busing was a noble experiment that had a lot of good intentions and a lot of great effects. And because schools are so less integrated today than they were in the late 1960s and early 1970s, that we need to resurrect this program. And the only reason why it was viewed as a political failure is because of white racial resentment. That seems to be the consensus. And guys, good luck in November.
Wow.
That's going to be your takeaway. I mean, we have collective amnesia. I wasn't really sentient. I don't even think I was born when this was a really big issue, but I was, not really politically, sentient in the late 1980s. So we don't have a ton of polling on this in this century. In fact, none in this century. But the polling that we do have from the late 80s and early 90s suggests this was really unpopular with just about everybody, and not just whites, but a plurality of African Americans also said as much, and with a lot of good reasons for it. Because if you only review the history a little bit, this program was a failure on its own merits. It intensified racial resentment, it accelerated trends towards racial geographic self-sorting, it closed African American schools. It wasn't just white people who were bused to districts far away, it was African Americans who were bused too. People who lived in their district couldn't send their kids to their district because they had magnet schools, had to keep seats open for white students who weren't going there anyway. It was an abject, ridiculous effort in social engineering that failed in every possible way, but the left has gone completely nuts. They're embracing policies that have no constituency. Who does this appeal to, Christine?
Well, I think there's an interesting thing that goes on particularly on the progressive left, right, where an abstract principle is embraced and then all of history is made to conform to that abstract principle, right?
Sure.
So when it doesn't conform, when, polling did it, but when African Americans and white people are all saying, this was a really dumb idea, it's the opposite of localism, it's the opposite of liberty, it is the really very heavy hand of the federal government trying to solve a complicated and nuanced problem with a sledgehammer. We know this. We know this from history. When this comes up again, there's just the abstract principle at play of, we have this racial inequality. Here's a way to solve it. And of course, the solution from the Democratic side is always the federal government intervening in local decision making, in home, in private citizens' decisions about, I want my kid to be able to walk to school, and whatnot, all in the abstract pursuit of racial harmony. So I thought that the other thing about the Kamala Harris moment was how heavily scripted it clearly was, and that the fact that everybody
by Kamala Harris, not by Joe Biden.
Exactly, exactly.
Very ill-prepared. Well,
we should probably describe what she actually did.
Yes.
All right. So
okay. One of us.
Noah, you described.
So, as I recall, Senator Harris turned to Joe Biden, deftly, in fact, because he was evading all attacks as the front runner in this field by a mile. He was not being targeted as such, which you kind of saw coming because he's not running in the progressive primary and everyone else is. But Harris turned to Joe Biden instead. You know, you wanted to talk to you briefly about your praise for segregationist senators because it was personally very hurtful to me. And she went into opposed Joe Biden's opposition to busing, which was not a controversial position until 35 minutes ago. And she said, you know, I was one of these kids in Berkeley who was being bused, who was in a school that was being integrated. And that little girl, who it was me. It was not an abstract thing. And it was a really effective moment. It was emotionally affecting, and I thought it was probably pretty deft theatrically. But in the hours that have played out since have been pretty divorced from reality, the political reality. I mean, the problem that Senator Harris is coming up against here, and she was quick to do it on the debate stage, and she's been quick to do it in the spin room, and she's been doing it ever since, is that she's not calling Joe Biden racist. But what other implication is there?
Right.
You're saying guy has praise for segregationist senators, opposes busing. I mean, you can be very charitable and say that's all attributable to ignorance. But it's ignorance with an element of racial hostility. And Democratic voters are not going to buy that Barack Obama's vice president for 8 years is a racist.
Well, there's also the fact that she very quickly, you know, in a kind of quintessential late capitalist moment, instantly started selling branded T-shirts with her childhood photo that said "the little girl was me" on her website, which that was it. I don't care how well she played that moment. The fact that she was at the ready with the branded T-shirts was enough for me. But I think, I mean, she could plausibly claim that what she's trying to do is show that he's too old and too out of touch with the way the country is now. But she's doing that by bludgeoning him with race. So I agree. I think it's completely disingenuous of her to suggest that she's trying to have it both ways. And you really can't do that. Either come out and attack him and say he's a racist, he's not what our party needs, he's not the leader we need for this time in America, or knock it off.
And she's also doing it by poisoning the discussion of race in this country.
Exactly.
I mean, you know, this is everything has to be revisited because everything, it turns out, was there had sort of a much more evil lining to it than we've been discussing openly.
I mean, so I guess she had to do it because she needed to get some traction. And in the polls, she's not been performing very well. She's a 5%er. We only have one poll that was taken in the time that has elapsed since the debate, and I don't really trust it because of the period in which it was in the field. But still, the Morning Consult poll shows her jumping from 6% to 12%. Now, that's a huge jump to double your support, but in relative terms, you're still only at 12%. Joe Biden slipped a little bit from like 39% to 33%. I mean, you still have the support of a third of the field after this really super dramatic moment. And in retrospect, we could come back to look on this debate performance as a disaster, because what did she do on the debate stage? She, again, after a disastrous performance with this issue previously, said that she supported the abolition of private health insurance and has been defending that position. But she already had a disastrous news cycle around this. She was on a town hall stage with Jake Tapper and said, yeah, let's get rid of it. Let's just dismissively, let's get rid of health insurance. That's in the Bernie Sanders bill, by the way. Anybody who's a co-sponsor of it signed on to that very policy. And a firestorm erupted. Democrats said, wait a minute, I don't support that. A whole bunch of Democratic senators came out, including Cory Booker, who's also a co-sponsor on this bill, said, I'm out. I don't. That's too crazy for me. And then Harris sort of backtracked, and now she's unbacktracking her backtrack. And now she's had to come out in support of forced busing, which literally has no constituency whatsoever. If she's holding to these positions that make her not viable in November, has she won anything?
Well, she is now being talked about by media figures as a superstar who's come into her own and who delivered a sort of magnificent, you know, defining performance.
I suppose. I mean, her stock was undervalued for a long time.
She's much more charismatic and appealing politician than Elizabeth Warren is, for example, just as a retail politician. She's just much more appealing. So I can see that. I agree. I think she was undervalued to begin with. Can I just say one word, though, that one thing this debate, I hope, has finally killed is the ridiculous you know, accountant like measuring of how many words women spoke versus how many the men spoke, because Kirsten Gillibrand, besides being annoying as all get out throughout the debate and proving herself not ready to be at the top of any ticket ever, was just constantly interrupting, right? And she was butting in there so much so that everybody else was getting highly annoyed. And so I think that the man interrupting, mansplaining meme is finally over, because the women on the stage spoke plenty. I mean, granted, we should spend a moment talking about Marianne Williams.
Absolutely.
Just for the sheer pleasure of it. but I was very glad to see that, because I had been seeing that kind of forensic accounting of how many words the men spoke versus the women spoke after the first debate. And, you know, it drives me nuts. So hopefully we can stop having those discussions now.
I mean, I really do appreciate Marianne Williamson's presence on that stage, just not for just the psychedelic value of it.
It's her aura. Her aura.
She definitely has this sort of new agey vibe, which is cool, but she also like assaults, verbally, rhetorically assaults the people on that stage, goes right for the jugular, and they only ignore her.
With love, though.
Well, oh, but she was, I think she had the best line of the night, which was to say, if you think standing up here and talking about policy is going to beat Donald Trump, you're insane. Like, she was right. She's right.
I mean, in a way, But she's doing it because she has no plans, and she's very proud of her lack of plans. She's like, you all have a bunch of plans. I don't.
Right.
Well, vote for me.
That sort of makes her the Democratic Trump. I mean, she's sort of all sentiment, yeah.
Sure, yeah. And she's got the Oprah tie-in, so she really could channel that energy if they wanted to.
But there were a lot of interesting things about that debate, I thought. Among them is the fact that including the moment with Kamala Harris, Biden didn't do terrifically well.
No, I didn't think he had a good performance at all. You know, I've seen people who were like, I didn't have Twitter on, and Twitter distorts your view, and believe me, Biden did fine. Kamala Harris was electric, but Biden did just fine. I don't know. I thought he definitely lost a step. But he's in a tough position. How does he respond to those attacks? Even if he was being forcefully defensive of his position, good for him, but you can't, I mean, because of the nature of your opponent here, you can only go so far.
Well, and in the days since, he's been on the campaign trail talking to group. I mean, didn't he have a Rainbow Coalition meeting, you know, right afterwards, and he gave a more vigorous defense of his civil rights record to friendly crowds who basically said, yeah, you know, it's fine. He's fine. We're good with him. African-American voters are good with Biden.
And they may be. We had, I forget where that came from. I think it was Morning Consult that suggested that Biden's favorabilities among African-American voters increased. And the theory was, and I'm attributing this to no one because I forget.
Democracy Corps? What's
Democracy
it called?
Corps, yes. Yeah. Thank you. Stanley Greenberg's outfit. So, yeah, they said that Biden's favorabilities among African-American voters increased because of the perception that—
Increased 18% was the figure.
Substantial. Yeah. Because the perception was that the Obama administration's legacy was under attack, which is where I said it at the time, this is a really risky play because you're going after Obama's VP on racial hostility, whether you want to say so or not. That is the nature of this attack. And if you're not going to take Vienna, you know, don't do it. But she's sort of having it both ways, and I think it's going to backfire.
Well, it also had the effect of making him look a little flat-footed, you know. I mean, he aside from the content, he wasn't terribly sort of quick and clever about coming back.
Yeah, I don't know if that's Biden's appeal. I don't think anybody who's in Biden's camp is like, well, that guy is a rhetorical genius.
No, but the fight, the idea of the fight in him, if he doesn't show it, it stirs up talk about his ability to take on Trump.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a great moment for him, that's for sure. But he didn't cause himself any giant disasters that are going to follow him for the rest of the race.
I agree.
I can't see that. Whereas on the other hand, Kamala struck out on a thin limb here, and she's going to have to be careful about it. But was there anybody else in that debate who turned into a good performance? Christine, well, you were talking about Gillibrand. I swear I don't remember a thing she did.
All she did is try to interrupt, and when she had a moment to say something, she said nothing that wasn't vacuous. It was a terrible performance.
Yeah. I thought it was a terrible performance as well. The excuse me. The interesting thing to me is that I thought Pete Buttigieg gave a really interesting and impressive performance, and seemed to have gone down somewhat in support as a result.
Yeah, the pundit response to him was, this was actually really a great, you know, presidential display. But yeah, I mean, he seems to be static. And that morning consult poll was really interesting because it showed movement from precisely two candidates, Harris up, Biden down. Static everywhere else across the board.
Really, although Buttigieg has posted some good fundraising numbers lately, so he hasn't taken too much of a hit there. But taking responsibility, I think, does gain you with the pundit class, but not with the angry constituents who you're actually serving. So he's, you know, I thought he did well in responding to the question about, you know, the police violence and whatnot. But he's not liked at home.
Because it was kind of a great moment. I mean, at least a standout moment when he was asked why the police force in South Bend was so predominantly white and why that hasn't changed. And he simply said, I couldn't get it done. And then sort of went on to talk about the larger issue.
Yeah.
And it actually, his response and particularly his temperamentally calm and serious demeanor throughout made, I think it was, wasn't it Swalwell who was the one attacking
Swalwell,
him? Made
him yeah, look, why
yeah,
didn't
he
you
looked
fire
like
him?
A buffoon. He looked like a buffoon. I mean, he actually came out the worse for the wear of that interchange on the stage, I thought.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that. Also, though, Pete didn't respond. Probably because he doesn't have a response. And I'm not even sure whether he's at liberty to simply dismiss the police chief there. But it's one of those things you don't even really want to go into. Any more final thoughts on the debate?
Bernie, the fact that Bernie was kind of irrelevant to things. I mean, to some degree, because the whole party has sort of moved so far over to him that he doesn't. Stand out in the same way, and I think he's lost a little fire.
Well, really? And John, I think John gave a great. He said he was like the yell-splainer. Yeah. He was the yell-splainer that night, and the yelling used to be kind of, you know, refreshingly bracing to all the people who'd never been yelled at by a crazed older socialist last year. But now it's just like, oh, I mean, we were kind of joking when we were all texting together watching the debates. We're like, he's like the crazy grandpa, right? He's like, enough already, you know. Kind of between him and Marianne Williamson, it really felt like a dysfunctional Thanksgiving dinner or something.
But with everyone else on the stage talking about giving away everything for free,
right?
He becomes part of the scenery.
No, we kind of thought that he would. I mean, the competition would be between Elizabeth Warren and Sanders, and Warren would turn in such a great performance the night before that she would chew into Bernie's support, and the two of them are playing for not the same voters exactly, but a similar pool of voters. And again, if that consult poll is right, just zero movement. It's like they're a non-factor.
Well, when I say Bernie lost a little fire, all I mean is that, and this was true and noticeably true of both he and Biden. They were the two, and the oldest, who on more than one occasion had to lean in with their hand up by their ear on a few occasions and say, well, I'm sorry, what? Could you repeat that?
Right.
And
Bernie Sanders never answers a question.
Right.
He doesn't answer your question directly. He might reject your premise.
Right.
But he doesn't answer your question. Right. I suppose the pundit assumption here is that it's no longer the two old white dudes who are carrying this race. And all evidence we have suggests that nothing really has changed.
Right. No, the geezer strategy continues to work. I mean, Kamala Harris notwithstanding, they're still ahead in the polls.
Right. Well, before we go on to the next topic of discussion, I want to talk to you briefly about Harry's Shave. Harry's founders were tired of paying up for razors that were overpriced and overdesigned. They knew that a great shave doesn't come from gimmicks like vibrating heads, flex balls, or handles that look like spaceships, tactics that the leading brand has used to raise prices for decades. They fixed that by combining a simple, clean design with quality, durable blades at a fair price. Harry's brought a world-class factory in Germany that's been making quality blades for over 95 years. They've received over 20,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot and Google. Harry's replacement cartridges are only $2 a piece. That's half the price of Gillette's Fusion Pro Shield. Join the 10 million who have tried Harry's. Claim your trial now by going to harrys.com/commentary. I think we've gotten some Harry's products in the past. I certainly have gotten some Harry's products in the past. I'm especially a big fan of the shave gel, or the body wash, rather, which has a very floral scent. It's almost, you know, kind of like a Earl Grey tea, which, if you know, sounds maybe a little less appetizing, bathing in Earl Grey tea, but I like it quite a bit. So if you go to harrys.com/commentary, you can get a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Weighted ergonomic handle, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, that's the stuff, travel blade cover. Listeners of our show can redeem their trial at harrys.com/commentary. Make sure you go to harrys.com/commentary to redeem your offer and let them know we sent you to help support the show. So, yesterday, while the president is in East Asia for a G20 summit, I believe, he decided to make a quick stop over to the DMZ, where hijinks ensued. The president's North Korea strategy, which is very strange all around, I think we're going to get into it, has now culminated in him becoming the very first president of the United States to set foot on North Korean soil in what appeared to be a whim. I don't think any of this was staged. He decided to meet Kim at the DMZ. They met at Panmunjom, and they stared at each other across the divide, which is a unique set of circumstances, but at least the divide was still there. And then Kim said, you know, if you come over, you'd be the first American president to do it, and he did it.
Well, that is emblematic of his entire North Korean policy, which also seems to be a bit of a whim, and has yielded nothing so far except humiliation and elevating the worst regime on the planet to a sort of level of diplomatic parity with the U.S.
Right.
There seems to be this strange sort of thing going on where in Trump's mind, Trump's North Korea policy in his mind is it's kind of got the makings of a Hallmark television romance movie, right? It's like, you know, they exchange these lovely letters and then they finally see eye to eye across the DMZ. He steps over. It's big moment. It's very, you know, this idea that his personal charisma can carry diplomatic weight. I think he really believes it, and probably some of the people who advise him believe it. But as you said, Abe, it hasn't led to anything. In fact, it's led to a less safe world if you start thinking about the retrenchment that they're now floating as a possibility, where we accept North Korea as a nuclear power rather than trying to eliminate them as a nuclear power, and say, oh, well, we'll just have to contain them now. So this is a shift.
Yeah, so we should talk briefly about that, and then I'm going to monologize a little bit about why this is a complete mess. So yeah, there was a New York Times piece today which floated the possibility that the administration would all but recognize North Korea as a nuclear power if they could have some limited demilitarization, some limited denuclearization, something verifiable. It felt like a trial balloon. And then the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, came out on Twitter and forcefully pushed back on it, suggested that this was a float from somewhere that was an effort to box the president in. There should be consequences. I think a lot of the press thought that there should be consequences was directed at the media, but obviously not. It was directed at members of the administration who are doing their best to make policy through the media. That seems to me like something you should perfectly legitimate to get really mad about. But, you know, the big obstacle there is going to be verifiability, and it just is not going to happen. You know, we've spent the last 2 years now trying to get an inventory out of the North Koreans, a list of what your capabilities are, facilities that produce bombs, how many bombs you have, what they can do, where they are, that sort of thing. So we can check it against our own intelligence and demonstrate that we have a good partner here, a good faith negotiating partner. That's not been forthcoming, to the humiliation repeatedly of Mike Pompeo, who at one point was even dispatched to Pyongyang to bring one of them things back and came up empty-handed. They're stringing us along. So a lot of Americans have a trouble understanding what we're sacrificing in this process, because diplomacy is good. As long as we're talking, we're not shooting at each other. And what are we really giving up? It's pretty intangible. So three things we're sacrificing. The first is irreplaceable time. Over the last 2 years that we've been negotiating with the North Koreans, their nuclearization efforts have accelerated. They're making fissile material. They're developing and expanding long-range missile facilities. They're testing long-range missiles and engines and components. And they're building bombs. We know all this. The administration's intelligence officials say as much. The second thing we're sacrificing is leverage. The American president only has so many things to offer the North Koreans that isn't sanctions relief. And among them is things like a visit to North Korea. I mean, that's a huge gift. And we're just giving it up for nothing. At the beginning of this process, Kim was a relatively new head of this regime, and he had not left North Korea since he went abroad for education. He was pretty isolated, and the concern was that if he were to leave the country, he wouldn't have a regime to come home to. So when we began this process, we began integrating him into this region, and he began making trips to Beijing, and then he went to Singapore as a rock star, and then he was, I forget where the second summit was. Where was the second summit? Somewhere in Southeast Asia. And he's been now all over the region touring as this, you know, cult celebrity figure. So his internal position is strengthened as a result of this process, even though they've sacrificed nothing in the form of nuclear weapons. And the final thing that we're sacrificing here is American prestige. I don't know, that might sound to lay readers and lay listeners like, yeah, what is that? That's, you know, that's nothing. That's just pride. But not really. If you're talking about a nation's word and honor and the capacity to be held to a commitment and to realize and manifest its agenda in the real world, and if it repeatedly fails to do so in the case of North Korea, that's a sacrifice that you're not going to get back.
I'd say there's an additional sacrifice that's enormous too, which is has to do with our ability to keep the world safe in the future. If this is where we are now, see, because then where will we be in the future? What will we accept? And with whom will we talk next? If this is the North Korean regime is as bad as it gets, and even if we could get the kind of verifications and honest accounting that you were talking about before from Pyongyang, it would still be a horrible idea to say, okay, well, in that case, we will sort of let you sit on X number of. Weapons of mass destruction, and we'll just sort of keep a watch on the stalemate from there on out.
Well, and we've played. Trump's so gullible, which is the one thing that he's always boasting about not being when it comes to being a player on the foreign policy stage. But he played right into North Korea's hands here, right? Because he allowed himself to become a propaganda tool for a murderous regime and yet called it
again.
A win. Right, again, and all for a photo op. I mean, that's not diplomacy. That is, you know, that's gullibility.
Yeah, and we'll never be able to say again in the case of a bad actor, we shouldn't, you know, we need to be tougher on them. We shouldn't talk to them. If at any point people can say, well, Trump, the president spoke to Kim Jong Un in North Korea. What are you talking about? You know, we have this is an uncharted territory, and it's bad. It's a place we shouldn't be in.
Right.
That's like, it's that mistake of thinking that showing up is the same thing as doing something, right? But that's Trump's MO. I mean, he's a reality television guy. Like, you show up, you do your take, and then you leave, and you're done. But that's not how diplomacy works.
Pretty sure that was Woody Allen's maxim.
Is it?
Like 90% of success is just being there, which is words to live by, I think. So I mean, what international actor would look at this process and say, I'm not going to start a nuclear program. That could be the world's worst thing for me.
Right.
The realist community says, well, look at the Libya example. You know, that's Gaddafi giving up all his weapons of mass destruction programs, not fissionable devices, mind you, but weapons programs. And they still went to war with him. And nobody wanted to overthrow the regime, but the regime collapsed anyway. And there's something to be said for that. I mean, the realist community now says, look, there's going to be a nuclear North Korea. They're not going to disarm. And we're not going to invade and disarm them. So the accepting reality is your last source of legitimacy here. Eventually, you're going to have to face up to the fact that North Korea is a nuclear power, and you can't disarm them. You can only contain them. And it's hard if I have an answer for that, because that's really the truth. I mean, the response that I have is that nuclear weapons are only one of the threats that North Korea poses. That it's a state sponsor of terror, that it exports drugs and weapons to really disreputable actors, and that it's generally a menace, and nuclear weapons are only one facet of that menace, and the only way you're going to neutralize all those threats is to get rid of the regime, and anything that does that, save war. Nobody wants to go to war because it would be a disaster, but anything that promotes that kind of instability from below, including and especially a sanctions regime, a crippling sanctions regime, is valuable and necessary policy. There cannot be a normalized relationship with North Korea ever.
Yeah, I mean, to the realist argument that says, look, you know, you're not going to get the nukes from them, I would say, but not accepting it is its own form of pressure, and it actually serves to keep them in between certain parameters, though they change. At least we're applying some pressure,
right?
Well, and just to the rhetorical point, which I think is a lot of what, if you're thinking about the Trump voters in the lead up to a re-election campaign, he actually called setting foot in North Korea a great honor. Really doesn't sit. He said he tweeted it, I think he said it, or said it to one of the Pool Reporters report. It's like, he's like, okay, we're leaving. It was a great honor to be here. And you think, no, that is not what the president of the United States should be saying to North Korea. There are lots of things he could have said, but calling that a great honor is not one of them.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the worst mistake of his presidency. And sort of if he keeps it up, it'll be untold how large the mistake is.
That's pretty substantial. I'm going with the failure to execute strikes on Iran when they were on the table, and we apparently go for that because they'll reverberate throughout history. But it's been a pretty bad month when you think about it in those terms. So I mean, now I suppose that negotiations are going to restart at a lower level, which is where they should always have been, something ministerial. But nobody expects that anything's going to come from this, right? I mean, we don't. North Korea is going to jump at the prospect of nuclear recognition in name only, but no behaviors are going to change, right?
Yeah, I mean, hardcore Trump fans will already be calling this.
Of course, they already are. It's absolutely historic, and right. I mean, sometimes you got to kill some people, but that's just the nature of the business here. Everything that the president does, I mean, this president more than others because he's so thin-skinned, especially his mistakes and his blunders have to be absolutely genius because he cannot allow for any sort of criticism. Before we move on again to our final topic of the day, I wanted to briefly touch some base with you about our new sponsor, Lending Club. If you're carrying revolving debt, that means you're not paying off your credit card every month and could be paying thousands in interest every year that you really don't have to. With Lending Club, you can consolidate your debt, pay off credit cards with one fixed monthly payment. Since 2007, Lending Club has helped millions of people regain control of their finances with affordable fixed-rate personal loans, no trips to the bank, no high-interest credit cards. Just go to LendingClub.com. Tell them about yourself, tell them how much you want to borrow, pick the terms that are right for you, and if you're approved, your loan is automatically deposited into your bank account in as little as a few days. Lending Club is the number one peer-to-peer lending platform with over $35 billion in loans issued. Go to lendingclub.com/commentary, check your rate in minutes, and borrow up to $40,000. That's lendingclub.com/commentary, lendingclub.com/commentary. All loans made by WebBank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. So the story that overtook social media this weekend, but not mainstream media, for reasons that will become obvious moving forward, is the ongoing efforts by what we call the amalgam of groups that make up what we call Antifa to essentially take over the city of Portland. I mean, they're running just amok and don't seem to have any police interference whatsoever. And this has been going on for the better part of a year, maybe more. And prominent journalist by the name of Andy Ngo was broadcasting from one of their marches, as he tends to do. He has his shtick, really, where he like focuses on these groups and what they do and how aggressive they are. And
he's a conservative journalist.
Asian gentleman who's really good at documenting some of the stuff that the mainstream press won't touch, particularly those quarters of it that see anybody who calls themselves anti-fascist as the embodiment of Winston Churchill, but also because it reflects really poorly on places like Portland, Oregon, which you can't blame a Republican on any of this. So he was assaulted pretty brutally, and there's a lot of video evidence of it. The new thing is milkshaking, what have you. So there's a politician in the UK, I think it was a Brexit party guy, maybe UKIP, who's had a milkshake thrown on him, and it became like a phenomena on the online far left, the extremely online left. Now they were milkshaking him, but apparently there were reports from the police department that it contained a substance similar to quick dry cement, which is certainly constitutes assault. He was also hit with in his face with people who were wearing these reinforced gloves, and they were really beating him up. And apparently he had to go to the emergency room and had some head trauma. So it was a really serious thing. And you know, for the most part, the reaction in people who were on Twitter was generally, this is bad, including liberals were saying, you know, this is bad, never assault journalists, what have you. But there was also the pretty healthy contingent of activist radicals who are also members of the press, albeit an alternative press, who weren't all that disappointed by this result. So this is a guy who's made them look bad for a long time and who's agitated in their view and got what was coming to him.
Well, and that was the part that struck me, is that they basically made the argument that horrible people make about a woman who is raped and happened to be wearing a short skirt, for example. It's like, he deserved it. He had this coming. There were some completely factually incorrect claims that he was inciting a mob by just standing there doing his job. They've also said, oh, he's not a journalist. You know, he's a conservative blogger. The amount of excuse making for violence is terrible. And the thing is, even if you accept their argument that he's not a traditional journalist, it makes it worse that he was attacked. He was an innocent bystander in that case. He was just someone who showed up. And he, I think part of their frustration is that he doesn't fit the identity politics boxes that they would like. They would like him to be an angry white dude so they can say he's a fascist. In fact, he's a gay man of color who happens not to share their politics. So it has led to this wild overreaction on the part of many of them because they can't square that circle.
I mean, he's been focusing on Portland for a real long time because the images and videos coming out of Portland are absolutely dystopian. I mean, these are gangs that are taking over street corners, and
they're attacking people who just like happen to turn down the wrong street. They start pummeling their cars and beating them up.
Yeah,
no,
right.
I mean it's blocking, anarchy. Blocking,
basically barricading streets. I mean, it's a lawless environment, and the police department there has been absolutely complicit in the sacrifice of their city to these insane mobs. You saw them kind of go dark on their Twitter account, the mayor and the police department. They've briefly mentioned it with the whole quick dry cement thing, but they seemed disinclined to prosecute the case when it went viral and when people started actually paying attention to it, when national rather. But the extent to which you've seen silence from the mainstream press about this is really, and by which I mean in national print and in opinion sections in print and on cable news. I mean, it's really frustrating because this is an absolutely an assault on rule of law that's been building for some time. We've been talking about it for years now.
And a few notable exceptions. Jake Tapper sent out a tweet saying this is unacceptable. A few people in mainstream media have said it.
And Brian Stelter said the same thing, but
yeah,
did he cover it on Sunday morning?
No.
And of course, you know, the thing is, he would have, or someone would have, had it been a right-wing group that was attacking a left-winger.
Okay, I saw that too. So this is the pervasive notion here on the left, is that political violence is limited to, almost exclusive to, the right, especially in the Trump era. Murderous violence in particular is limited to the right. And so when an episode like this happens, it's covered only because of its novelty. At least that seems to be the consensus that I saw from the people who were inclined to defend this sort of thing.
Well, look at the coverage, for example, of the sentencing to life in prison of the man who drove the white nationalist who hit the protester in Charlottesville with his car and killed her during the protest in Charlottesville a few years ago. He was just this past week sentenced to life in prison. That was widely covered all over the country and even in international media, as it should have been, because this is an important case. This was an important moment. there's no way that Andy Ngo's case is going to be covered in the same way. And honestly, this is the kind of moment where we talked a few weeks ago about the Oberlin Bakery case and the lawsuit. This is an example where, you know, you kind of hope somebody starts a legal defense fund and encourages Ngo to sue the city of Portland, sue the mayor. I mean, maybe that's the way to get some action, because the voters aren't going to turn these progressive local legislators and mayors out. But maybe money will talk. They'll have to sue them into oblivion to get anything to change.
But this is the phenomenon I wrote about in the book. You know, so I talk a fair bit about violence, political violence from these fringes in the book. And one of the things that's fueling it is this sort of fear of alienating people who like violence. Like, nobody says, okay, Antifa is part of our political constituency. There aren't a lot of Republicans who say, yay, all right. But at the same time, they're not out there sister soldiering them, you know? No one's out there defenestrating these people like they deserve, out of the fear that maybe they'll have a bad news cycle on Twitter, I guess, or they'll alienate the progressive or far right radical fringes who don't identify with them, but certainly don't want to see one of their own sacrificed like this to the mob. That's a real perverse incentive structure, and it's only begetting more violence. I mean, at what point are we going to wake up to the cycle?
Right, and it also speaks to something that we've talked about multiple times on the podcast about this civility debate, right? This idea that, you know, there was one of the other things that popped up over the weekend was another opinion piece in the Washington Post by the owner of the Red Hen restaurant, who basically was saying, you know what, it's okay to spit in the drink of someone who's related to the president because Trump.
And in the New York Times, or in an op-ed, yep. Calling for the doxing. I'm not calling for doxing, but calling for doxing in all my name of border security professionals, people with CPB, because they're complicit in these crimes against humanity, and the only way it's going to stop is by making them extremely uncomfortable or fearful to leave their house.
Well, and so that principle should hold both ways. Arrest the Antifa guys, strip off their masks, post their photos online, and let's see if their employers still want them working for them, right? I mean, if they are indeed employed. But this impulse is bad. It's bad when it comes from the right. It's bad when it comes from the left. And I think that the rage and anger about the way in which something like Andy's case in Portland wasn't covered by the mainstream media. And it's kind of gallows humor, but the tweet I saw over the weekend that struck me was someone said, you know you're a progressive if you believe mm-hmm. Jussie Smollett, but not Andy Ngo. And that kind of summed it up.
Speaking of Jussie Smollett, did you see the video that was produced, Christine?
No, I haven't.
There's a video now of the night of the incident when police responded. It looks like a body cam when police responded to Smollett's home, and he indeed has the rope around his neck.
Oh, my word.
It's quite a sight.
Oh, boy. That's one we'll be revisiting, I think, in months to come, that case.
There's an independent investigation, isn't there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so that one's going to, I mean, I bet we could probably all prejudge the outcome of that one.
You know, regarding the owner of that restaurant that asked...
The Red Hen.
The Red Hen that asked Sarah Huckabee Sanders to leave. So he's become, I mean, just look at, as a mark of where civility is, he went from saying, you know, he was very scared afterward because there were so many threats against him and, you know, maybe he had gone too far, to now he has come out. He is the sort of spokesperson for incivility in public life. Sort of, you know, he's got your back.
That's
a preposterous position. Yeah.
Well, yeah, she's Stephanie Wilkinson, who's the co-owner. There's two owners. She did. There was this sort of hand-wringing about it all when that happened. But now it's basically, well, we're going to change the rules because we don't like how, you know, we don't like, they, it's the moving of the goalposts, which we've often tracked with regard to these issues. But it's not, I mean, again, I don't understand the partisans on either side who embrace that way of thinking, because if those are the new rules, they will apply to you when you're out of power
this
as well,
is the
or
philosophy
in power.
That believing that you're in a war with your political opponents and that all things are justified because it's an existential threat, this is what it gets you. And we're a couple of steps down the road from real political violence. And we've already seen it begin again in this country. And it's not going to be pretty when it returns. And there's a lot of romanticism about this phenomenon because it's been dormant for decades, for a generation, and maybe more than a generation. But it's when it returns, it's not going to be pretty. And on that note... Very happy note. I think we'll probably call this one. Thank you so much for tuning in. We are not going to be here on Thursday because it's the 4th of July. So give us that, guys. Just let us take the day. John will be back next week, and then the whole team will reconvene on Monday for another fabulous episode of the Commentary Magazine podcast. Have a happy, safe, and healthy 4th, everybody, and we will see you next week for Christine, Abe, and John, wherever he is. I'm Noah Rothman. Keep the candle burning.